Hi, this is Chris Evans recording another Storage Unpacked podcast. This week, I'm here with Martin again. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good, thanks. Not too bad. 2 days in a row, eh?
Yeah. Well, won't be out 2 days in a row, though, will it? Unless no. You're going to be super efficient, Chris.
Personal joke, I guess.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, this week we have a guest, and we're talking with Erin Brown from Infinidat. Hi, Erin.
Hi there.
How are you doing?
Very well. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. So I believe you are the CTO in EMEA for Infinidat. Why don't you just give people a bit more background on you and what you cover?
Thank you. I come from 15 years in the infrastructure world, most of them in storage. For the last five, I've been with Infinidat, or as we like to call it, about 4 exabytes worth of time for the company. And Infinidat, if anybody is yet unfamiliar with us, we are a storage company that's solving the data management problem at scale for customers. As we transform into digital world, we're generating more data, and customers are often reaching for solutions that give them cost, performance, and capacity within the same solution. And that's what we tie in and help our customers sustain their data growth without inflating their IT budget. In fact, shrinking it down a little bit.
Okay, great. Thanks. So the topic of conversation today is really to look at the whole idea of data security in that hybrid storage model that we're moving towards. So the world is moving very much away from the walled garden of IT where we had our own data centers, and we're starting to see people putting data into the cloud, people putting data onto devices that are very closely located to the cloud. And obviously, this is something that Infinidat are very familiar with as your products and solutions have evolved. So we thought it would be great to talk to you, understand what you're seeing in the market, and understand how customers are solving this problem in terms of a security, from the security perspective. So, Erin, can we start perhaps by looking at the way that you're seeing the market change? I very much said that I think people are moving into the hybrid model and putting data into co-located services. But what are you seeing in general? Are you seeing that really being adopted heavily?
I think we're seeing a lot of customers that are now open and are, in fact, actively searching to expand from just on-premises storage or maybe even a local private cloud further out to the cloud. I think they're also, in the context of our discussion around security, are asking now new questions around what does that mean in terms of my security risk and my attack surface, etc. And I think essence of that question is the fact that we still expect privacy. I mean, contrary to what Mark Zuckerberg may say every other week, privacy is still a social norm. And if I want to protect my customers' privacy and I'm going to the cloud, there are new questions that I have to ask.
Okay. And I would say that Facebook as a consumer site is one example of looking at that. But actually, when you're talking about enterprise data, your level of responsibility is incredibly different. You have a duty of care, I would say, to look after the security of that data on behalf of the people whose data you're storing.
True. And I think we're going to be seeing new security tools, and especially we're going to see security kind of focusing higher and higher up the stack. When I say higher, of course, I'm thinking about the application on top and, you know, the pipe storage backup, et cetera, on the bottom. I think we're going to start seeing more and more security floating to the higher tiers because there's somewhat of a filter down effect where if data starts its life secured, you can actually keep it secure throughout its life cycle.
Okay, let's go into a bit more detail about that, because the most obvious thing you'd think about when you think about security of storage would be the physical side of it. Having it in your own data center gives you a degree of security, and we're already used to the idea of encrypting drives and all that sort of stuff. So I think from that side of things, people are probably pretty okay with that. But in reality, as we move to a hybrid model, it becomes much more about that logical security than physical, because we now don't have any control of that hardware.
Well, that's definitely one aspect of that. But I would argue it's not that cloud, whether it's a local cloud provider or tier one like Amazon and Azure, their level of security is not dramatically different. It's the tools that you have to use, and as a result, the skill set you need to have in your organization to secure the data. So I'm going to take a guess that, you know, the three of us can go into a room with a firewall, and between the three of us, we can probably get it up and running, properly secured within, I don't know, a couple of hours. But if we were to go into the same room and try to properly secure a cloud instance that has a web-facing, kind of public-facing side, that's a whole different skill set. And that's a skill set that is currently in a very dramatic shortage. And as a result, we've seen these cloud data breaches over the last years that were not a problem with the tools, that were a problem with the configuration, with the people planning the security of those environments. So I think that's the main challenge right now. It's not just that we're going outside of our perimeter. It's that we don't have the skill set to properly, or don't have enough people with the skill set to properly secure that cloud instance.
Martin, from your perspective, how would you deal with that? I mean, obviously, you've got more than a responsibility in your environment than just the storage. You know, you have a wider remit. How do you handle that side of it?
What, the security in general?
Yeah.
Well, it's all about locking down. I actually think Aaron makes a good point that we're going to see security go farther up the stack. Because the importance, certainly from a storage point of view, data needs to be open and accessible from the applications at the right time. We have applications going up and down in theory, potentially a pub-sub model as well. So we're expecting to see security to be embedded in the applications. We'll do our limited amount of physical security, and to a certain extent I do include firewalls in physical security, even though they're obviously a network level security, but encrypted disks, secure rooms. So, but as Aaron points out, I mean, as soon as we start moving up the stack, those skills are in real short supply. So I don't have a lot of security experts working for me. I would say, is that we've got any listeners out there who want to make a lot of money and retrain yourself as security experts or call yourself a security expert. It does seem to be it's a license to print money at the moment.
So Aaron, just can we go into the detail of what the sort of skills might be? You know, what is it that those sort of people are actually securing, and what are they doing in terms of implementing a security model around the data?
So I think we will have to kind of divide our applications into, I would say, three groups. One is greenfields. If I'm developing a new application today that needs to contain personally identifiable information, PII, anonymization is actually extremely efficient because it minimizes the size of data that you have to encrypt and allows a lot of the data to stay in clear text without the risk of a data breach actually discovering any new information about any data subject. So for new projects, anonymization will actually be very good. Problem with anonymization for existing applications, whether they're on-premises or being moved to the cloud as an infrastructure as a service project, the problem is that this requires changes to your data structure. So let's say you're based on a database and you keep a lot of PII in some of the tables in the database. Now you have to kind of tokenize or somehow anonymize the data in that table. And that means changing database structures, all your query optimizations. This is really a massive project multiplied by the number of applications that contain sensitive data. No enterprise would go into such a project, or at least no enterprise would do it successfully within the time we have to comply with the regulations. And we're just seeing more and more regulations. So if you look at GDPR, for example, Article 34 says, if you have a data breach, you need to show to the regulator that the data was not accessible if you don't want to notify your data subjects, which is kind of the PR nightmare. So companies looking at existing applications can either go into this massive anonymization project, or they can just encrypt the data. GDPR clearly says that if the data was encrypted, you don't need to notify your data subjects. And I want to pause here and add the proper disclaimer that I'm a technical guy and not a legal guy, of course. But Article 34 clearly states that. So encryption is going to be incredibly efficient in helping us meet regulatory requirements for existing applications. And it's going to be further needed even more when you go to the cloud, where you want to make sure that any cloud provider data breach will not expose your own data.
Okay, I would say that encryption, though, depends on where you do it. So first thing that springs to mind there for me is encryption in the hardware, which we've had for many years, is one thing that's good for physical removal of devices. Encryption in the transport of the data from, say, shared storage to an application host, again, is something that we've had for a long time and is doable. But we're now having to think about encryption at a higher level, because now if the host itself is breached, or the network, the front-end network is breached in some way, if the data isn't encrypted there, then surely that's as equally, that's sort of like it makes the lower level encryption as less, not necessarily less relevant, but it sort of negates the work that you might have put in if you're making it as easily accessible at a higher level.
I think you touched one of the most critical points. I think people today often think that if data is encrypted at rest, which you refer to as hardware encryption, they are encrypted. They kind of mentally check that box. Well, the whole advantage of hardware-based encryption is its transparency, the fact that it does not require you to make any changes. But that's also its weakest point. It leaves all the other tiers, like the network that you mentioned, completely exposed. So there is, as I said, a filter down approach where if you encrypt the application, everything becomes encrypted, including your local storage, your WAN, your remote storage, cloud, whatever you're using. So that would be ideal, but making change to thousands of applications is a complex process. I think we'll see healthcare financials do that. But I think for the majority of customers, we're going to see encryption in flight and at rest happening with tools like vSphere's VM encryption and Oracle's TDE, Transparent Database Encryption. And Microsoft has a similar feature. We're going to see Thales security encryption on the file system level. These are things that are easier to integrate. They're more reasonable from an operational perspective in terms of the overhead that they add, but they solve the problem And then once the data is encrypted and it stays encrypted throughout its lifecycle, you can be secure that any of those lower tiers could get breached and you're still okay. In a way, we have to kind of design for the day after the data breach and not just trying to prevent the data breach. Because if Google and Facebook can both have data breaches in the same month, we all have to realize how susceptible we are to social engineering and other attacks that will expose our data.
Okay, now, one thing that springs to mind with that discussion, certainly when you talk about applications that might need to be rewritten or the actual impact of rewriting, and that is assigning, I guess, risk to a platform that indicates the level of encryption or security that's built into it. Now, I don't know whether that exists today in the market or whether people do that, but it seems to me one of the logical things you could do is you could create a risk profile against every application and say, well, you know, this one's low risk, high risk because of the features that are in it. And then as part of your application rewrite over time, you may add that as one of your considerations for how you decide to rewrite an app, whether you choose to put that level of encryption in or other features in order to get around that risk.
I think you'll find that's going on at the moment, Chris. There's a lot of risk-based assessments going for an application rewrites. So certainly around personal identifiable information, there's a lot of discussions about that, GDPR. I've been involved in conversations in my day job. I know plenty of other people who have been involved in those sort of conversations. So we're trying to pick off those targets where we think the most risk is, and we'll start working on those. Often we'll, as Evan's already mentioned, we'll be looking at things like Oracle transparent data encryption, things like that, which potentially mean there's a minimal impact to the application. So we don't actually have to do a massive rewrite. So there are things which you can drop in, which are already just drop in, so you don't actually have to completely re-engineer your application. Ironically, I think some of the legacy applications will be easier to work with than some of the web scale applications.
I think you're touching a very good point, because in modern web scale applications, microservices, etc., will have to get encryption all the way up to the application level. And just like in many ways, we've seen a lot of building blocks being provided. So for example, Intel and AMD now provide encryption acceleration libraries to reduce the CPU overhead. We're also seeing companies actually bringing developer SDKs to allow them to handle strong encryption without the complication of actually writing the encryption algorithms. So they're making them available across multiple platforms so that, for example, if I develop an application for mobile and Windows and Linux concurrently, I can use one SDK and tie that in. So I think in some regard, you're right that today it's still harder. It's getting easier. But if you look at those more traditional apps that you mentioned, oftentimes, you know, I haven't seen a customer that doesn't still have like 1, 2, 3 Windows 2003 systems or very old operating systems, the ones that you really don't want to touch because they're running some critical service on the back end. They're already virtualized. You just don't want them to break. You don't want to invest any time in making changes there. And for those, I think we'll see vSphere encryption as the de facto standard going forward once customers kind of align to version 6.5 and 6.7, which will take probably a couple more months.
Now, we'll move on from encryption in a second, but one of the things that strikes me as being very much an issue with encryption is the concept of managing keys. I don't know how it's done within, say, Oracle TDE or any of the other platforms, but the biggest risk from any sort of encryption has to be key management. So how will that be managed when we have such a diverse and distributed set of applications that we have to look at?
So you have to remember that the problem of key management has been solved for us by governments. So solutions exist. But over time, we had a forking effect where we kind of developed two concurrent standards for key management. One is KMIP that has been around for years and is mostly used by storage vendors and vSphere. And the other is exchanging keys across a trusted socket using HTTP-based APIs. So think RESTful API over TLS, for example. So when customers are looking to find key management solutions, they'll be smart to look for solutions that cover both options. Otherwise, they'll end up with multiple key management solutions. But I think most of that problem from an operational perspective is mostly solved by now. Because again, governments have been doing this for years. Banks have been doing this for years. The protocols are in place. The integrations are in place. The ecosystem of, for example, the hardware security modules that generate the keys, the protocols to exchange the keys securely, the smart cards to back up the keys. These are all things that are already in place. I think we have to ask potentially a different question. If we start encrypting upstream, what happens downstream? What are the kind of secondary, tertiary effects of that? Because there are things that change and some things that break as a result.
Well, the obvious thing to me that would break would be anybody who's doing dedupe on their storage platform. That seems to be the most obvious one.
you're right. This would be the highest cost impact. And this will apply to both primary storage, of course, DR and production or active-active deployments, but also to the backup tier. And we're seeing a lot of interesting discussions there. So I was just participated in a project where one of our customers has, they do financial services and they needed to encrypt 12 petabytes of very sensitive data that included customer data. And because they're financial and they're American, they fall under the new NYDFS cybersecurity regulation. So they just encrypted the entire database. And they used, by the way, Oracle's TD. And the immediate growth of data as they could no longer use things like compression was a huge impact for them. But their reliance on data reduction wasn't that high because that's the way we operate. Our cost savings comes from other places. And if they were relying on a 4-to-1, 5-to-1 data reduction, that would have completely changed the economics of that project. On the backup side of things, we're actually seeing two very distinct kind of implementation types. So let's take VMware as an example. When you use VMware's native APIs to backup, VADP, the data gets decrypted again. So on the one hand, you can dedupe it on the target again, so you don't lose data reduction on the secondary storage on the backup tier. But on the other hand, you now have a whole new attack surface that you have to care about. So we've seen customers telling us, oh no, we don't want to lose data reduction, so we love vSphere encryption. We've seen customers that are saying, no, it's too high of a security risk. Will just back up the data encrypted. So these are definitely the two tiers, storage and backup, that will see the highest cost implication as a result.
So let's just qualify that. So VADP, when you use it, it effectively decrypts the data before it is made available to that API.
Yeah, before it's being sent to the backup software that you use.
Okay. So your attack surface becomes the backup solution.
Yeah.
Which in many cases, if you are, like a lot of enterprises have been, possibly not as secure in any way as your primary environment.
Very often, yes. But I can tell you that I'm talking to a lot of financial customers that are actually becoming very aware of the fact that advanced ransomware is actively trying to corrupt backups. So what they're doing is they're running their backups. And during the backup window, they have a firewall port open that allows the backup to go through. The second the backup is over, they actually close down that port and they treat the backups as if they are detached virtually in that way. So some backup environments are starting to be more secure, but you still have the transport that you have to secure. So you have to make sure your data is encrypted in transport between the client and the target deduplication server, whatever you use. And then you have to make sure your data is also encrypted again by the deduplication engine or whatever you use to back up your data.
Martin, from your perspective and from mine historically, I've always seen backup not really being treated as quite as secure as it should be. A lot more people potentially have access to do restores of data than they should. And it makes, and I'm not necessarily thinking of the actual platform access, but you know, just that ability to be operationally involved. And that is interesting that it seems to be more of an exposure than it ever used to be.
I don't think it's more of an exposure than it ever used to be. I think it's been a misunderstood exposure for a long time. Your backup admin's potentially the most powerful person in your IT organization. They can do all kinds of things. They can steal your data. They can inject files into a backup. So when you do a restore, you suddenly know that you've got rootkits installed on your system. It's amazed me that backup actually hasn't been more heavily compromised or more discussion hasn't been made about how we need to make sure those environments are secure.
Yeah, me too, because from my perspective, half those things you've just described, I think I've done over the years.
What, stolen data, Chris?
Not stolen data, no, not stolen data, but certainly the concept of injecting files into a backup.
Yeah.
Not necessarily into a backup, but certainly if you wanted to get a file into a library that you didn't have permission to, the backup software would have more permissions than you would because it could restore any file at any time. So as long as you had that permission, you could back up a source file, modify it and restore it back in place with the backup software quite happily. So yeah, you're right. That's existed as an exposure for a long time, but clearly now it's more important than ever.
I think it's becoming more understood. Backup was boring for a long time. The backup admin was a poor, ignored person. Now people begin to realize how important it is. And yes, as we get data security and data leakage, I think people are going to realize more and more how important having that core environment secure is.
Another thing that strikes me as we have this conversation and as we move to talk about the public cloud in a moment, and that is the whole idea of containers and microservices. And we've talked a lot about the storage, perhaps, but there's a certain degree of trust that needs to be developed and and exist between the storage and whatever's running those microservices or those containerized services. So surely that must be another angle where we need to have some sort of an increased level of awareness, and that's the trust between whatever containers we're running and the storage that it's going to access.
Well, containers will communicate with the storage over a data path. This could be shared persistent volumes through NFS, or maybe dedicated persistent volumes through iSCSI. And those data paths don't really provide that level of exchanging security. The best case scenario is you have something like encrypted iSCSI channels. I think it makes a lot more sense, going back to our previous discussion around the filter down effect of encryption, to just have your microservices encrypt the data and only have the relevant containers that need the encryption key to have it in memory. And then the storage will just get all the data encrypted. And, you know, we have to remember, storage, there were 2,000 data breaches recorded in the data breach incident report last year. None of them attacked the storage layer. Storage is pretty secure. They will always go where it's easiest. And by the way, humans are more often easier to jeopardize than technology. So I'm not that worried about whether or not my storage media is encrypted. I'm worried about whether my data can be exfiltrated from the application or, you know, the network, the storage, any other layer, the WAN, for example. So microservices, as Martin said earlier, will be harder to do because you'll have to build encryption all the way up to the application. But that's already something that a lot of people are already doing. So I don't think it's a big problem. I think it's just another effort that you have to put in. And the one thing people often neglect when they plan their go-to-market with a product or a microservice is if you don't put security by design on day one, it becomes a technical debt. It's something that you'd later have to go back and fix, usually a lot harder to fix once you've already launched. It's a lot more complicated. So we have to all, as a community, as IT globally, find a date for each company that we say, after that date, we no longer will launch a new application that doesn't have security built into it from day one. Otherwise, we're just adding more work instead of saving work.
And I think that's probably relevant more in a distributed environment that we're moving towards. So we haven't touched on it yet, but obviously that brings us on to the idea of hybrid and increasing use of public cloud. Now, my first, I guess, worry with any of that, or my first consideration is always, I guess, we could apply security in one place. We could apply security constructs in another. But how do we make sure that they're consistent between both locations? That, to me, seems like the most obvious one, never mind making sure that we're applying security in the first place.
I'm not sure I follow you.
As we move towards a hybrid and public cloud model, one of the things I see being an issue in terms of how we build out our security model is that public cloud providers may implement their security models in a different way, have different key management systems, allow you to store keys in different ways, allow you to manage the trust permissions between applications and their data in different ways. And somehow we need to find a way that makes that consistent so that whenever we apply our policy to data, if the data moves around and the app moves around, we don't have to think about how we reapply that security set of credentials as that application pops up in a different place.
So I would say that that is one part of a wider discussion that I will categorize as data gravity, but I'll get back to that in a second. I think that the customers that are really security conscious and are also thinking forward and asking, how do I avoid cloud vendor lock-in, are realizing that they already have the key managers on premises. And these are usually hardware modules that are high entropy, the highest level of security, and they already have the procedures to back up the keys locally. So many of them are talking about, let me keep my key manager on premises. Let's have the cloud instance authenticate and get its keys from that HSM on premises. And that way I can run VMs or containers or serverless architecture in Amazon and potentially other cloud providers, and they will all consume the same key source, the same HSM. So that prevents that problem of cloud lock-in. But I would argue that the wider lock-in that we see from the cloud is data gravity. I spoke to an analyst 2 weeks ago, and he had a phrase I really liked. He said, we're all going to be subject to data gravity. It will drive a lot of the discussions and a lot of the decisions we take about where we place applications. If you want to be proactive as an IT organization, your first question should be, how do I make sure the center of gravity is somewhere I can control and not within, for example, Amazon, so I don't have to pay egress costs? So going back to microservices now in your example, if I want to run some containers on Amazon and some containers on Microsoft Azure, I need them both to be able to access the same data set. So, for example, the same persistent storage layer on the back end. And I also need them to be able to access my keys. And the solution to do that is not to go for the easy solution and use Amazon's key management service, but rather use your own key management service, which will require a little bit more engineering effort, and then use cloud adjacent storage or cloud storage that enables you complete data sovereignty. And in that regard, we're seeing more and more customers that are asking us to do kind of a private instance where they want to use our storage in their in its cloud configuration, but they don't want to share the hardware.
Okay, so you're talking about adjacent, I think you sometimes call it sovereign cloud storage, but basically customer comes to you and just says, put a box in a co-location environment next to the cloud provider, and we want exclusive access to that, but I want you to link it in, effectively giving you local storage, but actually full control over that asset.
Exactly. And that solves the data sovereignty problem. And I'm currently involved in a big RFP for a financial customer, insurance company, that they want to have a cloud strategy, but it's going to be a phased approach. It's going to take them a few years to do it. But they want to make sure that whatever they put on premises now, they can mirror for disaster recovery as a service, for example, on phase one. So only have the DR in the cloud. Later on, they want to start moving VMs non-disruptively to the cloud. And then they want to own the app. Well, they want to have sovereignty over the asset in the cloud, but they want to consume it in a cloud model. So they don't want to own the asset. They don't want the CapEx investment.
That makes complete sense. There's no point using cloud services and going back to buying and having to install your own hardware and having the CapEx issues. Martin, one question for you here, and this may be more applicable to the type of data that you deal with. A lot of what we talked about so far to me seems to be what our class is, not traditional applications, but certainly applications that are OLTP or transactional based. And I can sort of see the logic in what we've talked about and how you could secure that and you could make that work. What I am struggling with is, I've been watching the AWS keynote today, and there's a huge amount of new features coming out from Amazon that are talking about managing your data, taking it from the edge, you know, transforming it, putting it into a huge data lake. So there's a big drag from Amazon to try and push you towards putting all of their stuff in. But there's obviously a lot of implications in doing that. And your data is more that sort of type, isn't it?
Yeah. So we're looking at how we would use cloud storage in general, and it's the size. And yet again, if egress was 3, we might actually use a lot more cloud because it's not 3. But that's a problem. So I know a few vendors have also tried to do this. I remember back in the day talking to Nimble because they had cloud volumes, and it was a very similar idea. They'd put an array in a colo and they'd have fast connections into Amazon and into Google or whoever, but you'd still own that asset and you'd have control over it, but it allows you to run multi-cloud. Storage and data gravity is the reason why a lot of people can't do multi-cloud. If you have a lot of storage or a lot of data which you're going to be moving around between your clouds, a multi-cloud really doesn't work for you.
You touch an interesting point, and maybe kind of closing a circle to where we started. Data sovereignty, one of the solutions is to just encrypt your data, so you're no longer worried about sharing that infrastructure. The data never leaves your applications in clear text or your database, so you maintain some logical data sovereignty, even though you don't necessarily have the physical data sovereignty.
That's true. I guess that is one solution to it. So let's just... as we're coming towards the end of our time, why don't we wrap up on that then in terms of customer strategies? Let's talk about what you're seeing customers doing and what you think are the right strategies that customers should be focusing on as they go forward in this, in dealing with the security issues.
So the first one that I always ask my customer is understand not where you operate, but which citizens you serve. Because you might operate in the UK, but you serve Australian customers and they have their own privacy regulations. So you have to understand your ecosystem first, the requirements. Then, as you're starting to look at encryption, anonymization, etc., start mapping out the downstream effects of them. So anonymization, for example, requires a lot of database administration work. Encryption requires you to rethink your storage strategy and how do you reduce your dependency on data reduction. And the same, of course, goes for the backup tier. The next level is to ask where you should encrypt your data. And anybody who's looking for one silver bullet with one answer will realize that it's very limited. So as I said, that old Windows 2003 VM, that's likely going to be encrypted using vSphere encryption. But if you have a problem with the exposure of the backup tier, you may choose to use other things for your more critical infrastructure. I don't think we'll see a single encryption solution being used by large enterprises. It's going to be at least two of them. And the last one is customers are starting to set cutoff dates. Most of them are talking about January 1st, 2020 as kind of a throwing a dart at the calendar and saying, all right, 2020, we no longer launch a new application without putting encryption or anonymization on some other secure process in place. And the last piece is if you are going for granular encryption, like the database option, you have to put a data classification process in place. And the number one risk for a data classification process is the fact that there are kind of columns in the database that are unclear. So when you have a field that's called telephone number, there's a lot of enforcement that you don't put anything else there. But when you have a free text field, you will find that a lot of these fields, people copy and paste credit card numbers, social security numbers, passport numbers, etc. So for a data classification process, a lot of the customers are just opting to encrypt by default anything that's free text.
Just one last question then. What about job roles in this environment going forward? You know, who's currently responsible, and do we think that's good enough in order to make sure that people understand the technical implications of what levels of security they need to be putting in?
For the most part, I'm seeing two main personas driving this. It's either C-level executive, could be a chief risk officer, chief legal officer, the CIO, people who understand the business risk as a result of a data breach. And they're driving it as a top-down approach. But what often happens then is they start getting quotes from their technical teams that are saying, oh yeah, we're relying on this technology and it will stop working, so we need X amount of money to compensate for that, and they get stuck. Sometimes it's hard for them to justify $20 million investment in infrastructure because of whatever infrastructure they're depending on to minimize business risk, that the fine for will probably be $5 million. So we have to rethink how do we put the right tools in place to help those people. And then the other people I see driving these are either security people or infrastructure managers who, again, have a more technical understanding of the problem or are getting requests from somebody outside of IT to start encrypting. And they're looking for technical solutions to the problem, but they're not necessarily aware of the business implications, or I would say the entire business implication to their organization.
I think, Martin, it seems to me like we have this discussion quite a lot where there seems to be a need for a person who can span both scenarios, that understands the business and can actually talk technical. And with cloud and with the more hybrid environments we're moving towards, that to me seems to be more critical than ever.
Yeah, visibility to something to interface between the technical teams and the business teams, understand the implications of decisions made both from a business and a technical point of view, and translate it, be that go-between, a technical service manager maybe.
I'm not sure exactly, you know, what job title you choose, but it certainly seems to be that there's going to be more of a requirement for people who can play in both camps and can actually liaise between them. And it's, if anything, from a skills perspective, when we talk about people saying, oh, well, you know, as we go forward in cloud and we're not running infrastructure anymore, people will lose their jobs. In fact, actually, as always, I think what we're doing is we're creating more complex and different and interesting jobs. And this sort of problem is a perfect example of that.
And we will continue to have companies complaining that there's a skill shortage when they have many people working for them who have skills who could be retrained. So instead of just thinking about where you're going to get those new skills from externally, look at retraining your existing infrastructure or your existing developers and see if they have the aptitude to move into these roles. Most of them already have got half the skill set, and that's the technical skills. So you may be able to find that you can train them or get them more business friendly.
Yeah, true. Okay, well, that was a great conversation. Can't believe we've come to the end of our time so quickly. So, Aaron, from your perspective, where can people find you online, social media perhaps, and where can they find more about Infinidat and your products?
So I'm mostly on LinkedIn. That's where I handle most of my social media. Aaron Brown, you can find me quite easily. Infinidat, you can find both on Twitter and LinkedIn. And we have an Infinidat EMEA account as well that caters for our multilingual audience. And for our multilingual audience, we have the EMEA website, emea.infinidat.com, which has both the multilingual content and actually has a dedicated page on data security that has webinars, white papers, things that people can read if they want to take it one step further.
Lovely. I'll dig that page out and I'll put that on our show notes just so that people can find that more easily without having to go looking for it. Okay, well, thanks very much for your time this week, and look forward to catching up with you another time in the future.
Thank you.